In a world of uncertainty, one thing is for sure. Cancer doesn't stop during a global crisis. On Saturday, June 13th, the LLC, Leukemia Lymphoma Society, will host a trailblazing event known as the Big Virtual Climb, which is sponsored by AbbVie, to support their investment in groundbreaking research to advance blood cancer cures and its first-in-class patient education and services, including financial support and clinical trial navigation. Step up to take cancer down by climbing 61 floors or 1,762 steps, inside or outside, on stairs, on the road, or on your treadmill. Climb your way. Join us for an opening ceremony and then take on your climb with our heart-pumping playlist. Join us on June 13th from coast to coast as we come together to climb, conquer, and cure. Register at lls.org/bigclimb. That's lls.org/bigclimb.
Happy Wednesday, everyone. My goodness, I've missed you all so very much. It is May 27th, 2020. My name is Sean Ashadi, my friends. Welcome back to the Man and the Myth podcast here on The Athletic. Man, how's everybody doing? We appreciate you guys. Missed you over the long break. Hope you're enjoying our time apart out there. Hope you're out there staying safe. Hope you're all just out there really having a great week. Producer Chris, he is here, manning the boards, as always, as is my guy. He is my better half, my East Coast spirit animal. Some are saying he's the best writer I know. I don't know. He's the myth. He's the man in the hat. He is Chuck Mendenhall. What's going on, pal? You enjoy this long break that we had?
I really did enjoy this. You know, for us, it's a long break, right? We always do the Monday show, but with Memorial Day, we did not do that. And it felt like this feels foreign to me suddenly. I'm so used to doing the Monday show. Now it feels like we've been away for so long, man. It's going to take a minute.
It was a good refresher. I won't lie. It was a good refresher, but it is good to be back. Hopefully all you guys out there, like I said, enjoyed the long weekend. And the train picks back up this week. The first of presumably many events to come at the UFC Apex starts right now. It's funny. The UFC booked this fight night before the Nevada Athletic Commission even met to vote on whether combat sports was going to be allowed back in Las Vegas. Yeah. That actually happened this morning, just a few hours ago, and wouldn't you know it. That. Combat sports are officially back on in Las Vegas. Almost like it was a foregone conclusion. The UFC knew what they were doing, but hey.
Yeah, I think it was just coincidence, Sean. I think they got lucky.
They're getting lucky a lot lately. Vegas is back on the menu anyway.
Yeah.
Get used to seeing the UFC Apex on these broadcast fields because it is going to be like this for a while. And as I said, it starts this weekend with a, I don't know, what do you want to call this? An all right show? An okay show? Nothing mind-blowing, but a very solid main event here with Tyron Woodley, Gilbert Burns. I don't know, Chuck, what are you seeing here from this Saturday offering in front of us? Yay or nay?
Well, we're in a pandemic, Sean. I don't know if you've noticed this whole thing. There aren't a lot of sports going on, so I feel like the UFC can get by with something here, but I gotta say, didn't we think that these cards are going to be stuffed with, crazy matchups, you know, going forward? I felt like we were going to get like maybe, you know, 5-6 really stacked cards before we started to thin out again. This feels like we're already thinning out a little bit, this particular card.
This is the first one that's felt like that, though. The past few have been pretty good.
I agree.
This is kind of the first time where we're really seeing like a noticeable dip.
Yeah, I mean, and it's not like it's not terrible, but you know, a lot of the people are just kind of
not terrible.
Let's put it this way, the intrigue on the card, you got to kind of search for it, you know what I mean? Like, generally speaking, a couple of the cards they ran out in Jacksonville, those fights just kind of popped off the page, and there were several of them on each one of the fight cards that they did. This one, you got to kind of strain a little bit to see those storylines.
It does feel like we're starting to feel the effects of the lack of foreign fighters. The not Fight Island not being ready, and sort of the lack of ability to get an international influence on some of these cards. Starting to feel it a little bit with this one, I would say.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't the government basically make an exemption for international traveling athletes who are coming over to compete? Or did I misread that headline?
They did, and it's going to be interesting to see how that affects Fight Island, because you're right, that would seem to throw all of this awry, but also, I don't know if there's other restrictions in other countries about people leaving.
That's a good
and the
point.
Whole thing. There's a lot going on.
I guess why I bring it up is I don't want them messing with my Fight Island, man. I got to see this now. We've built this thing up, and it's taken on a life of its own, and I have to see it now. The UFC has to do this. If for any reason they start to scotch it because they can get all the international fighters in here, I'm going to be disappointed, John.
You're saying we need our man in the myth on location, on the beach, yes. On Fight Island.
Yes, with Chris and his turntables, man. We'll do this thing.
Thank you. Thank you for including me. I would love to go with you guys.
It's on. We're doing it. I'll hit up some people right after we finish this show. But we mentioned it, and it feels like it's been forever since we've seen Tyron Woodley. Let's talk about this fight, because it really has been forever since we've seen Tyron Woodley. It's been 15 months.
Yeah.
Tyron has completely exited our lives since this title loss to Kamaru Usman. I don't know that he's missed much. The welterweight division is basically in the exact same place that he left it, but he has been gone, and now here is sort of where we're at. He's returning as a 30-year-old man. Welterweight has never really been an old man's division. He lost decisively to the champ. He has admitted to having money problems earlier this year, spent a lot of that cash that he earned as a champion, but he's still the number one ranked contender at 170. Chuck, where's Tyron Woodley in your mind? When you think of Tyron Woodley now, like, is this somebody who's still viable as a title contender? Or is what we're going into Saturday, is this like a do or die for him?
It's a tough situation, man, because I think you got to take into account the way he lost that fight to Kamaru Usman. It just seemed like he was bullied. He didn't really have a lot to offer in that fight. It was pretty one-sided, man. And you wonder when you see something like that. We talk about this a lot of times. Suddenly a fighter who gets into their upper 30s, or sometimes if they can, they can hang on to about 40, you know, 41. But they just have a fight where you start to see their decline. Now, did we see that with Woodley? I'm not so sure. That fight happened back in, like you mentioned, 15 months ago. But it was coming off the heels of one of his best performances against Darren Till. So I feel like there's a little bit of a... Was it just an off night for him? You know what I mean? Like, was it just one of those weird things? Or was this Usman just a different kind of beast that he didn't know how to solve and just kind of couldn't get anything rolling? And I think that those questions come in. But if he goes in there, and especially, and I know we're going to talk about this in a minute, but the smaller cage and everything that's kind of being put into this type of fight 15 months later, given that he's 38 years old and everything else that's going on, it does have a feeling like, maybe it's his relevance in terms of a contender or maybe a potential champion again, and his spot in that pecking order at number one. That's very vicarious. I feel like he can drop down into those and like pretty far with a loss. I think that's the danger. It's not just a couple of spots he would drop. I think he kind of disappears into that 5 to 10 range, and you don't want to be there in the welterweight division. So it wouldn't totally bury him to lose a fight, depending on how he does it, but I think it would really be detrimental if he has any more hopes of going for a title again.
Yeah, and this really is, it's a much different fight than we thought we were going to get with Tyron. The Leon Edwards fight, that's as close to a number one contender's fight as you can sort of get, right? Yeah. Like, that's not a number one contender fight for Tyron, but it's not the type of fight that would sink him down, throw him down the ranks if he loses. This, on the other hand,
right?
This is much different, and this kind of, as you said, is... maybe not all the way there, but it's tiptoeing into the water of that type of fight where Tyron could get hurt badly if he loses in terms of his ranking and his stock. Chris, let's bring you in here, man. I mean, when you think of Tyron right now, what do you think? Is this somebody who's still 38 years old, viable in this division as a potential number one guy? Or do you see that this might be a crossroads, do or die type of situation for him?
I don't know. I don't know if it's, I wouldn't say do or die necessarily, but I do think it is a bit of a crossroads fight, just in the sense, like you're saying, with Gilbert Burns, who's taking full advantage of the, you know, the open spots available during the pandemic. He's making the right choices here. He looks great, and he's taking advantage of that, getting in a main event against a former champion. It's very smart. A loss to Gilbert Burns, you're absolutely right, doesn't look great for Tyron, compared to had he lost to a Leon Edwards, who's a guy who really everybody felt like was deserving of a number one contender fight and putting himself in title position. It's very tough to tell, because that Kamaru Usman fight, he was dominated, but he didn't look right. You know, the Darren Till fight, he looked terrific. I mean, that was one that going into it, that felt like it could be a changing of the guard type of thing, and he made that look easy. He really looked great against Darren Till. So it's very hard to tell. I mean, I think we're gonna find out real early in this fight whether the Kamaru fight is an aberration, or if that's sort of where he is, you know, at this point. Yeah. I would imagine he's gonna be very motivated getting in there. we talked about some of the financial difficulties he's had, and I think he probably realizes that he did damage to his legacy a little bit here, you know, being out for so long and some of the other stuff that's gone down. So I would imagine he's going to come in very motivated. And like we said, we're going to talk about the small cage theoretically would benefit him with the power that he has, although grapplers tend to do well in a small cage.
I don't know if it benefits him.
Well, I think it benefits people with tremendous power, and I think it also benefits people with grappling. So that actually makes it a much more intriguing matchup to me going into it with the small cage. But we will see. I mean, I think he still has something to offer, but we'll find out on Saturday night.
Chris, you mentioned it there a little bit at the top. What Gilbert Burns is attempting here is actually really intriguing to me, because if you guys remember, it feels like ages ago. It really feels like ages ago, but he's already fought once during this sort of pandemic era. He ushered it in. He smashed through Damian Maia just as all of this was starting, and that fight was a total rout. And now he's back again, and here's what we have. And stop me when this starts sounding familiar. We have a streaking contender in his early 30s who is using the strangeness of all of these circumstances right now in the world to springboard himself into a big-name fight that he probably wouldn't have normally gotten. And now, because of all this weirdness, he actually probably finds himself like one fight away from the title conversation. Yeah. Does that sound familiar at all? Because I think I've heard this story before.
Well, you're describing to a T my boy Matt Brown. you know what, man? No, I'm just kidding. I know who you're talking about. You're talking about Justin Gaethje, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I agree. This kind of does have a feeling. It has a feeling, you know, all of these fights are weird. These initial fights to begin with, like just getting them off the ground. You know, the kind of musical chairs that they're playing, you know, with opponents and trying to, you know, fill out these cards. So this one has kind of like opportunity, danger. It's got caution. It's got all that tape around it. You know what I mean? And I feel like from Burns' perspective, mostly, obviously he's got something to lose, but he doesn't have nearly as much to lose as a guy like Woodley, right? Like, so it kind of has that feeling, and I felt, you know, it kind of felt like the Tony Ferguson situation in that way. Not quite, but it's like Tony Ferguson had a massive thing to lose in that fight with Justin Gaethje, and Gaethje was kind of like, you know what, man, I'm kind of playing with house money. I'm gonna go roll hot dice. I'm gonna beat him, you know, and he did. And I feel like there's a parallel.
It's not the same stakes historically as what we had going on with the lightweight situation, but just for personally, for Tyron Woodley, it's basically the same stakes that was on Tony Ferguson. Like, this is kind of the end of his run as this guy we think of as a potential champion and, you know, former champion and top tier contender. If he loses this, it's basically the same setup.
Yeah, and it's crazy because in that division, man, you know, that's the reason it's like this. You lose one fight. He loses to Usman, but he loses it, like we just mentioned, convincingly. And you start to, like, have some wonders. I think a lot of us were surprised at how he looked in that fight. But, you know, you lose one fight out of the last, what, eight? He won the previous, like, you know, six of the last seven. I think the one was a draw. But it's like he's going through that whole, you know, run. And one fight, and you can kind of slip down that rank or put yourself right on that edge of becoming that. And I think that tells you about the depth of this division and just how top heavy it is. Like, there's so much good talent right now that's all just thriving. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I feel like he does have a ton to lose if he loses this one.
There's also the other aspect of it too, is that he's never been really a Dana White darling. So it's like, if he loses a fight, it's like, he's going to have to fight tooth and claw to get back, you know, to the same position he's in now. And also something that I think I pointed out a couple of weeks ago, he was preparing for Leon Edwards. He's been in camp for a long time. He's looking at one opponent, and now, you know, I mean, obviously he's had a little bit of time to prepare for this. It wasn't sprung on him that quickly, but he's still taking a totally different fighter here, who has been active against, and what did you say, he was out for 15 months or something, Woodley?
Yeah.
So I mean, that feels familiar. That also kind of parallels what went on with the the Gaethje situation. So, you know, it's interesting. Mentally, he needs to be absolutely ready from the second that fight starts, or I think it could end up being a long night for him. But I don't think he's out of that fight. Just, it's an intriguing matchup.
Absolutely. I would say, though, I think it's pretty wild just how late all of this is sort of coming together for Gilbert Burns. Because you look at this guy, he's been in our lives for a long time. He signs with the UFC 6 years ago. And he's just, at that time, this sort of jiu-jitsu mega prospect. Like, we only know him as Vitor Belfort's grappling coach on Tough Brazil at that point. But you hear a lot about him, and he debuts as a welterweight. moves down to lightweight, immediately starts struggling with his weight. Immediately. He ends up just fighting infrequently because he can't cut weight multiple times in a row. So he's having these long breaks between fights. He's missing weight. At one point, he ends up going 3-3 over a six-fight stretch. Culminating, the end of that was a really nasty first-round knockout by Dan Hooker, which that win looks even better in retrospect now if you're Dan Hooker. And it just looks like, again, I say this all the time, but it just looks like Gilbert Burns is going to end up being one of those guys, just like a faceless name at 170.
It does.
And then all of a sudden, as these things happen, man, overnight, win, moves up to 170 for a short notice fight, loves it up there. I'm sorry, I meant that he was going to be another one of those guys at 155. But yeah, moves up to welterweight for a short notice fight, loves it up there. And now all of a sudden, we're looking at a 5-fight win streak, back-to-backs over Gunnar Nelson and Damian Maia. Chuck, I don't know, man. Like, this guy really feels legit to me. Did you ever see this coming?
No, man. I mean, I'd be lying if I said I did. I thought that, you know, going up to 170, it's such a... We've heard so much about guys wanting to go down. I always feel like there's still, like, a verdict out on, like, if, does it make sense to move up? Although we've seen a lot of positive results of guys doing that over the last year or two. He's one of them. But I think when he made the move... I was a little bit skeptical if he would be able to do that. You know what I mean? Like, there's just so many monsters in the division. But the way he has looked in those three fights so far at welterweight have been very surprising. I would have thought the Gunnar Nelson fight, which was pretty close up until the third round, he started to kind of make it his fight. Like, something like that was really eye-opening to me. Like, I was like, are we paying enough attention to this guy? And then you see him against Damian Maia, and like you mentioned, he kind of went right through him in Brazil and under the circumstances, everything else. Made it look pretty easy, and now he's in this big fight. I mean, no, I would have never. I didn't see this guy coming, man. I feel like he is one of those very quiet, dangerous guys. He's going to bring it, and he probably is thriving in this very unique atmosphere, like you mentioned.
Speaking to that, man, tell me if I'm crazy then, because to me, with everything that's going on at welterweight right now, you look at all this uncertainty. Jorge Masvidal. Seems like he's not going to fight Usman anymore. He's calling out Nate Diaz. You have Usman calling out Conor McGregor for some reason. The whole division doesn't make sense right now. Again, maybe I'm crazy, but is it possible that Gilbert Burns actually moves into that spot, that pole position spot, for a title shot if he wins this weekend?
Man, there is no crazy in this sport, Sean. Come on. You know that. No, but let's put it this way. Like, they've got, in terms of the official rankings, right, Woodley is number one behind Usman, right? So he has no path back to Usman, really, after that one-sided beatdown. I don't feel like it's an easy route for Woodley. But let's say that Burns beats him. You could say that, well, they kind of trade places. Now, even if you don't like that, you say, well, he shouldn't all go, you know, he shouldn't go in front of Covington or Masvidal or Leon Edwards. You just kind of look at that and you think, like, well, like you just mentioned, Masvidal would probably be the most obvious guy, but the title doesn't mean as much to him. It seems like he does want the money fight, the kind of, BMF title and all that stuff. He wants Diaz again. Okay, fine. Covington obviously is kind of in a state of constant disarray, and he's coming off a loss. Like, I'm not sure, you know what I mean? Like, suddenly he could be in front of that type of thing. And then Leon Edwards is always 80 fights away from a title shot. You know what I mean?
The circumstances are set up for it.
It just seems like poor Leon is always behind the eight ball. So it's like, you know, this would make complete sense if Gilbert Burns, like, kind of got in front of Edwards, basically filling in for him. So, yes, can you see, like, a weird scenario where this might work out? Yeah, I could see it. If he goes in there and plows right through Woodley and handles himself on the mic, he might be right there, man.
Yeah, I think he definitely could put himself in that conversation, because when you look at the top of the division, it's a lot of wrestlers. But theoretically, Gilbert Burns should be able to handle that. He's an incredible jiu-jitsu player. He can throw hands. I mean, obviously, he's a good striker. Yeah. So, like, he's a good matchup for himself, but a bad matchup basically for probably everybody in the top of the division anyway. Like, he's not somebody you want to go in there and think you could get a win against. It's not going to be an easy fight. And it's not funny, but it is kind of funny. Like you're saying about Leon Edwards, he's always 80 fights away from getting a title shot. He literally had a backstage brawl. Like, he had a fight with somebody that easily could sell, and he couldn't get that one. And the poor guy just cannot get into that title fight. It's wild.
Yeah. My year start prediction of Leon Edwards will have the belt by the end of the year is really looking rough right now, guys. There's no path for this guy at all. Yeah. I'll tell you what. Man. I'll tell you who the happiest person in the world will be if Gilbert Burns ends up somehow vaulting up into this position to fight Usman next. Ali Abdelaziz, how many divisions is it going to be where this guy is going to have both fighters fighting for a title? What?
Ka-ching.
Just wild. Last thing about this fight, and really about this whole event and sort of the stretch that we have coming up. So we find out this week that the UFC Apex events are going to use the smaller cage, which you guys have mentioned a couple times now, 25 feet instead of 30 feet. So you normally get these 30 feet cages for most events. We have seen in the past that these little cages, those extra 5 feet make a tremendous difference on how fighters perform in there. It forces more action. It helps out grapplers, as you said, Chris, and it also can really stifle a lot of the movement from the guys who move around a lot. Tyron Woodley moves around a lot.
Yes, he does.
What do you guys think? I mean, we have UFC 250 coming up next week. Every event from now on for a bit, except for Fight Island type of stuff, is going to be at the Apex, so it's going to be using these small cages. You have a big run of fighters that are going to be using this. Amanda Nunes, Sean O'Malley, plenty of big-name fighters are going to be affected by this. Yep. How do you feel like this smaller cage is going to affect these shows coming up, and in particular this Woodley Burns fight that we're looking at?
Well, it's kind of nice for the UFC because I think they prefer it, right? Like they want to have less space to run. They want guys to be in a conflict and where there's no place to run, essentially. And I think it generally is okay if guys are just kind of frenetic and they go in there and they want to stand or whatever they want to do. But like the bottom line is, as long as you don't have guys who generally run, right, it makes for a good thing. And from the UFC's perspective, this particular fight is like, it's tough to figure because, like you mentioned, it's almost like, of course, I think it will play a hand. It's just hard to figure out exactly how it will. We do know Woodley likes to move around, but he also should be the bigger guy in there. And I think that if he's as long as he's able to kind of neutralize things and kind of like make it a little ugly, like try to tie him up a little more and wear him down, kind of grind on him a little bit. It feels like there's a path to victory for him using, you know, his wrestling and then his heavy hands, just kind of like setting those shots up. But man, like we mentioned, it should favor grapplers. And I think that that's kind of a fascinating thing. You know what I mean? Like if it does go to the ground or if there's a crazy scramble, Woodley might be in some trouble in this fight. And it's just, I think that it adds a dimension to this one that wouldn't have been there otherwise. So I'm really interested to see how it plays out. But generally speaking, I feel like I don't really notice as much when they use the small cage. Like it's usually something that's brought up during the telecast, and you're like, oh, I'll pay attention to that. But there's not a lot of glaring things going on. But I know it makes a big difference to the fighters, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it is definitely going to make a difference. I mean, there's no two ways about that. And obviously the fact that it's no coincidence that the UFC put the smaller cage in the arena for the Contender Series, which is a thing where it's like finishes are really highly prized. That's how you get the contract. And if they wanted to put the bigger cage in there, I'm sure they could have because they designed the Apex personally. You know, it's not like anybody else came in and was like, well, we have to do that. They could have built it any way they want. So they definitely, it would seem, would prefer this. And yeah, I mean, grapplers are going to benefit from this for sure. But I still think that guys with tremendous power like Tyron Woodley, it's not going to hurt him as much because if he has to take, you know, one less step to connect with somebody, that's not going to hurt him necessarily. The ability to avoid the takedown and to avoid those scrambles, like you said, Chuck, is going to be a problem for him more so in the smaller cage. But I think somebody with that type of knockout power he's probably going to be fine no matter what the size of the cage is.
This does to me feel like it benefits Gilbert Burns this weekend. I am very intrigued, though, just to see moving forward how this plays out on some of these bigger cards, these pay-per-views where we're going to have championship fights and things like that. A lot of different events and a lot of different fights are probably going to be held at the Apex over the next few months. This is going to play a factor in all of them. We'll see. It'll be interesting. As we said, high stakes here in this main event. Really intrigued in this main event. So much could happen, and it could really change the shape of this welterweight division overnight. Let's real quickly hit the rest of this card. As we teased at the top, maybe not the best card, maybe not the deepest card. I don't know, man. I'm just going to throw this out to you guys. What's the second best fight on this card? Because nothing's jumping out to me as an obvious candidate, so I wonder what you guys are looking at.
I don't think there's an obvious one. Maybe Chris has a different version of this, but a fight like, for instance, we were just talking about the small cage and the contender guys. I think Roosevelt Roberts versus Brock Weaver, you know, could be a fun fight.
Yeah, totally.
Ooh, yeah.
Given, you know, just given they have some experience in this building and things like that. I feel like that might actually end up being pretty good. I'm personally kind of, I love weird storylines, and I love, you know, so seeing the Shevchenko sister, you know, stepping in there to fight Chukagian, who just fought, you know, Valentina Shevchenko in her last fight and got blown away. You got to think that there's weird motivations going into that one. And it's kind of intriguing. You wouldn't want to go lose to both of the Shevchenko sisters back to back. So that one kind of has like an odd appeal to me. But there's a couple of good fights on there.
So the Caitlin Chukagian fight is your second favorite fight of the card. That's saying a lot.
Yeah, that's saying something, right?
You're not wrong, though. I don't know. How about you, Chris?
Yeah, that's an interesting one, because, I mean, to fight Valentina for the title and then to fight Antonina next, like, no disrespect to Antonina, but that's not the same caliber. You know, I know they're sisters, but it's not the same caliber. So that's kind of a quite a fall there, I would say, for Caitlin.
Not to mention, what an interesting way to get back at Valentina, right? Like, sure. Because you know how these fighters are. They live. it hurts them worse to go vicariously through, like, a, you know, a teammate or a family member than to lose themselves. So it's like, in some way, it actually has more of an emotional stake for Valentina.
Oh, absolutely. I would definitely agree with that. The Roosevelt Roberts Brock Weaver fight is one that's standing out to me, because those guys are, I think they're just going to throw down. That's going to be a fun one. Scrolling down quite a bit, Tim Elliott's always fun. I mean, I don't really know too much about Brandon Royville, but that could be a fun one. Casey Kenny, Louis Smoka, but I mean, these are early on the card, and you know, we'll see. But again, I'm always favoring the flyweights, right?
yes, you are.
Yeah, but anyway, I mean, it's a little bit of a soft card, but we'll see. Maybe this small cage will help.
A little bit of a soft card. We hit like two fights before you got to the I'm scrolling through Wikipedia just naming off stuff part of the show.
Most of these cats don't have a Wikipedia.
Yes.
I will say, when I saw the Chukagian Shevchenko booking, I thought, my first thought was, wow, that's a masterful trolling by the UFC.
Yes.
Because you know those matchmakers are just kind of giggling to themselves when they book that one. But then you look at it and it's like, dude, that's actually a really insane opportunity for Antonina. She is not anywhere in this top 10, and Chukagian is like number two. She just fought for this title. Antonina, all of a sudden you might just have Shevchenko sisters all over this top five after Saturday. It'll be interesting. To me, my second favorite fight of this card is Mackenzie Dern and Hannah Cyphers. Your girl, Chuck.
Oh, yes. Can't get a word in edgewise when you're talking to her.
That is what we know about Hannah Cyphers, just a chatterbox.
Very, very talking.
Oh, man.
This is intriguing to me, man. This is genuinely intriguing. And Mackenzie Dern coming in off the first loss of her career.
Yeah.
We once pinpointed this person as a huge, 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 ultra mega prospect in this sport. Seemed like that was a thing for a while, and then she started to hit some struggles. She came back really quickly after her pregnancy and just having, you know, the birth of her first child. She came back really quickly last October, ends up losing that fight to Amanda Ribas. This is a big spot for her, man. This is a really, really big spot for her. If Mackenzie Dern is going to become who we thought Mackenzie Dern was going to be, this is it, right? Like, this is kind of the do or die type of situation.
Yeah.
She got the smaller cage. We're talking about how much that helps grapplers. I am curious, though, in this type of setting, this is somebody who doesn't really, let's just say she struggles making weight.
Yes.
And it's been something that she struggles with throughout her. Yeah, that's putting it very nicely. It's something that she struggles with historically throughout her career. Again, this is at 115. They seem very insistent on doing this at 115. They feel she's undersized at flyweight. Will Mackenzie Dern make weight this weekend?
Oof. Boy, that's tough, man. You know what? I doubted her in her last fight against Ribas. Again, you know, but given the fact that she was so recently a new mom, you know, and you're thinking like, dude, she already struggles making weight, and she made it. But she didn't look quite right. You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't like her best fight, but she did make it. I guess I'll give her the benefit of the doubt, but man, this is like some crazy circumstances for her to have to lose the weight, you know what I mean? And to get down to that weight, because obviously there's a pandemic. I can guarantee you that things aren't going to be very tailor-made for her. I'm sure she's got some good people around her helping her, but and UFC and all that, but it's going to be tough. But I'm going to give her the benefit of the doubt and think she gets it done. I agree with you about this fight, though, being somewhat like fascinating. Hannah Cyphers is a tough out, right? Like, we know that.
Oh, absolutely.
But what's the worst part for her? The worst part is doing a bunch of media and going out and in front of people and all this face. She doesn't have to deal with any of that. She's almost in her perfect environment, like a completely vacant building. So I feel like she's going to be maybe this might be the most comfortable she's ever been in a fight. So I'm really interested to see how she looks.
Right. That's really funny. Yeah. Hannah Cyphers was born to do social distancing. Yeah. She does not want to talk. I think Mackenzie makes weight. Let's give her credit. I mean, she's chosen to take a fight during all this. So, you know, good for her. She wants to get back in there. Let's assume that she'll make weight. And I think stylistically, you're right. Hannah Cyphers is a tough out, but I think stylistically it's a good matchup. I mean, Amanda Ribas, yep. You know, beat Mackenzie handily on the feet and really kind of dominated that fight. But I think it's a different opponent here against Hannah Cyphers, who's more of a, you know, makes it more of a dirty fight, like wants to grapple a little bit. So I think, you know, I think it's a good matchup for Mackenzie, and it is a big spot for her, but I think she'll probably come in and look pretty good.
Well, we shall see. This all goes down this Saturday. Fights are back, y'all. We got a string of fights coming up, fights next week as well. So it shall be fun. In the meantime, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to hit a bunch of headlines on the other side. Look, I don't wear very much cologne. I don't know much about cologne, but I do know that smelling good is important. And I do know that Hawthorne smells really, really good. So how does Hawthorne work? Well, it's actually very easy. You take a quick 2-minute quiz, and Hawthorne tells you the two colognes that are best for you. One for work and one for play. It's totally risk-free with free shipping and free returns. Father's Day is coming up. This is the perfect Father's Day gift. You can take the quiz for someone else if you need to. As I said, it takes 2 minutes. Hawthorne tells you the two colognes that are best for you. Check out Hawthorne at hawthorne.co. That's Hawthorne with an E and .co, not .com. Hawthorne.co, and use my promo code ATHLETIC to get 10% off your first purchase. That's hawthorne.co, and use my promo code Athletic to get 10% off your first purchase. Hawthorne.co. All right, y'all, we are back. A couple quick hits here to attend to that we have missed while we have been gone. First, fight bookings. A couple new main events we have on the schedule that have appeared in front of us. Joseph Benavidez, Davidson Figueiredo 2. This is one we kind of expected. Booked now for July 18th. Dustin Poirier and Dan Hooker also booked July 27th. So there's our two of our July cards. As I said, we expected Benavidez Figueiredo 2. That's a big spot here for Joseph. Yeah. Probably last title shot of his career. I know we keep saying that, but this has to be it. Really reminds me of like a Bisbing-esque type of make or break moment for this guy who, if he's going to do this, this has to be it. But I didn't think we would actually get Poirier Hooker anymore. I didn't think that would still come together. I'm a little surprised by that. I thought plans had changed after 249 and everything changed with the lightweight division. Now, you look at this 155 class, the piece is still on the board, assuming Tony is out for a bit. Yeah. Justin Gaethje, Conor McGregor, and Khabib Nurmagomedov, the last person who may be out for a while, depending on what happens with his father. I don't know, man. How do you move around this chessboard now at lightweight? Because it does seem like Justin Gaethje and Conor McGregor are once again on a potential collision course.
Yeah, I think that, you know, this booking to me points out the thing you're mentioning, that it might be very difficult to just do the most linear thing, which would be to have Gaethje against Nurmagomedov, given Nurmagomedov's situation with his father, everything that's going on. And then you have the Hydra element of having Conor McGregor floating around, you know, like he's right there kind of in waiting, you know what I mean? And I feel like he's the big ticket fight for anybody. So I feel like that those three, they're basically partitioned off now, and now it's the rest, right? And we've talked about this division a lot and how much depth there is, but these are the two best names in that sense. If you just look at it that way, these are the two best names right below it, with no Tony Ferguson in play right now, obviously. It's Poirier and Hooker, and I got to say, man, like, just the contemplation of that fight was pretty exciting. I'm like, dude, you think about what Hooker's been able to do over the last couple of years, and then Dustin Poirier kind of coming off his loss and just being who he is. You know, he was on a crazy streak before that. I think he still looks as good as he ever has.
Yeah.
You put those two together, that's going to be a dynamite fight, man. And given the fact that there is uncertainty, and you're going to see some version of those top three, I feel like it's the right fight to make.
Yeah. I'm honestly, I'm a little surprised that Poirier kept this going. I mean, we were looking forward to this fight before all the coronavirus stuff hit, and obviously it's good matchmaking. I mean, it makes sense. It's going to be a fantastic fight. I'm a little surprised because I feel like Poirier maybe could have. I mean, he obviously knows better than I do, but it seemed like maybe he could have angled to try to get in there against a Connor or whatever to try to work his way in. But you know, maybe he just would rather stay active and fight, not like Dan Hooker's some kind of gimme. I mean, that's going to be a war no matter which way you slice it. But it's great. I'm looking forward to that fight, but I am a little surprised that Poirier. Stuck to that booking, honestly.
It seems like the tea leaves are something. You know, like, if you look into it, it just seems like the UFC had to have cooled him. Like, maybe the matchmakers or maybe just the indication from Connor's camp or whatever it is, some combination of those things cooled him on the idea that it would happen. Yes. You know what I mean? Because I feel like he should have been fighting for that, the McGregor fight the whole time. But obviously, behind the scenes, something's going on where he knew he couldn't get it. So I think that that's why we ended up here.
Right. And it does seem like, based on all the rumors that are coming out, it seems like they're trying to push Connor back to 170, like keep him at 170 rather than get him involved in this title picture at 155, which is also interesting.
That's true.
Which seems insane to me because that dude's going to lose 10 times out of 10 to Kamaru Usman. Like, that's not a big fight even, really, other than the fact that it's coming against Connor.
There's your little snippet, Chris. Saying. Take that out.
I'm just saying, man. You know I'm right.
I can't disagree with that, man. I'm with you on that.
Let's keep it moving. Next topic. Bantamweight officially has no champion, y'all. It is real. This is real. Henry Cejudo officially removed now from the UFC rankings this week. That bantamweight title is vacated. I said from the outset that we would figure this out really quickly if he was bluffing or not. And against all odds, actually does appear that he was not bluffing. He is retired. Does this feel real to you guys now?
Well, it definitely feels real in that sense, because once he's kind of out of, you pointed this out, like if he's out of the rankings and he's basically rendered retired, right? Like he's out of the drug testing pool. It kind of goes a little deeper than just saying like, I'm retired. Oh no, I'm back. I do think that this kind of indicates it's a more of a long haul retirement, and I say that word in quotes, you know, like no matter what happens, he's going to be away from the game for a little bit. And, you know, obviously they got to proceed now with a different championship fight. They've got to figure all that stuff out. But it's a weird one, man. I got to say I'm a little surprised. I thought, honestly, I really believed when we talked last about, you know, his victory over Dominic Cruz, I was like, I feel like he's leveraging and like he's in a good place. He's not happy with what they want to pay him. He's not happy where he's at. He wants more money. And it seems like his conviction is a little more strong towards the retirement right now, at least, than I previously would have thought. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think even if it was a ploy on his part to say he's retiring just to try to leverage it and try to get more money, I think he probably knew that this was inevitable, that the UFC was going to act quickly to get the belt off of him and not hold up the division. Yeah. So like, I think, you know, whether he's committed to actually retiring and this isn't any kind of play, I think he probably assumed that belt was going to be going away relatively quickly. So he probably figured this was part of the process, and we'll see, because I think he knows he can just come back and he's going to get a title shot if he returns, you know.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
It's probably not the biggest deal to him that it got taken away, but it happened quickly, and I think that's probably the right move on the UFC's part, you know.
I agree with you, Chris. I think that this is probably, I mean, if not part of the plan, he definitely saw this coming. Like, you don't really play chicken with the UFC and win a lot of the time. So right. I'm sure he was fully prepared. And it seemed as though, from what he was saying, that he was fully prepared to walk away if he needed to. My question to you guys, I mean, this is our favorite game. Might as well drag it out right now. Odds makers, chances we see him again in the next 12 months, because I feel like it's pretty high. Like, I would give that a 50-50 shot right now that we're going to see Henry Cejudo back at some point, whenever there is a big fight at 35 or 25 or whatever, sitting there for him, he's going to announce himself and went back in, I would imagine. This is a man who's still in the prime of his career.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I'm going to say that it's going to be within 12 months. I think that that's what you just said is right. I think that this kind of is almost like his reputation as kind of like cringeworthy and all that stuff, right? You know, Captain Cringe, whatever they've been calling him, like it's ran its course. And there's like, by stepping away or threatening to step away, you wonder if the palate gets cleansed a little bit for him. Like, and people actually kind of pine for him or give him more recognition for what he's been able to accomplish. Because we've talked about this four-fight run, man, that he's on, and it's got to be right up there, if not the greatest you know, run that we've seen in UFC history. Like, it's got to be right up there, right? Like, this is a crazy moment. I think he'll be back, but I think that it may be smarter than we realize, a little shrewder, because maybe we'll be pining for a guy like Henry Cejudo rather than just kind of dealing, you know, putting up with him. You're kind of like, okay, we want him back. We want to see what he does against this guy or this guy. It might be a smart thing for him in the end.
Yeah, I would put it at 50-50 that he fights in the next 12 months. I mean, we'll see what presents itself.
Look at that limb he's out on, Sean.
but I think it is a good move. Like, rather than stay there, again, like, he probably assumed the belt was going to get taken away anyway, rather than hold it up and catch that kind of heat from people for the rest of the year or however long it's going to be before he fights, let the division work itself out. We know there's a bunch of contenders at the top of the division. Let them fight. See what gets established there, who builds their name a little bit. Somebody's going to call him out at some point. And I think you're right, Chuck. I think it's like it can be a little bit of a palate cleanser. Go away, come back, and maybe have a little bit of a different thing. Because everything he did up till now worked, shtick-wise, but he runs its course. And somebody we're going to talk about later, look at Colby Covington. He had an opportunity after the loss to Usman to drop the bullshit, you know, persona, and he didn't. And it just, now it's like, who wants it? You know, it's so old. So maybe Cejudo will take your advice there and come back eventually with a different persona. Yeah.
Chris, I have to say, that was masterful. I saw what you just did there, my friend. Yeah, that is why you're sitting with the keys to the ignition for this show, my man. Next topic, Colby Covington. This man is no longer with ATT. I think just made official today, just as we were about to come on the show. Interview with James Lynch. Doesn't seem to know where he's going to train next. He didn't really have coaches or anything like that. He was calling his new team and his new enterprise, basically, Colby Covington Incorporated. A lot of talk about, this is America, freedom of speech, blah, 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 lots of freedom of speech. I think he said, this is the best thing that could have happened to me, probably about 12 different times in a 5-minute span, which usually means it's probably not the best thing that could have happened to you, but he pissed off Dustin Poirier. He pissed off Jorge Masvidal. He pissed off Joanna Jędrzejczyk. He pissed off seemingly every big name at ATT. I don't know. Are you guys surprised by this? And was this inevitable?
No, I think it was inevitable, man. And you know, at first, I got to admit, like, I thought some of the stuff with Masvidal, because they were boys, man, back in the day. They hung out a lot.
They lived together for like 7 or 8 years or some shit.
That's what I'm saying. And they've got tons of stories. I feel like at some point that will probably rectify their, who knows? But like, they were boys. And I feel like once that started to deteriorate, I almost believed that it was just kind of a work, like they were just, oh yeah, let's angle for this, let's do for a money, you know, they're both big picture enough to pull something like that off. But as time went on, I could tell that there was some serious dissension in the ranks over there, man. And it wasn't just Masvidal. Obviously, you mentioned Poirier, but also Dan Lambert, you know, he's been on record basically saying, like, hey man, we don't throw teammates under the bus, we don't go do that in the press, that's not what we do, and if you continue to do that, you get outed, like we get rid of you. And Covington, man, it just seemed like that was his thing. Like, he was just going to continue to do it. That quote, like, what did he say about Joanna? He was saying something like she tried to flirt with him and he wasn't having it because he has standards. And he said something along the lines of some ugly woman from Poland. He's not going to waste his time on that. I'm like, dude, you can't go saying things like that. You know what I mean? That's crossing the line. That's not even Andy Kaufman. Like, I think at our most ambitious, we've called him names like that. Like, maybe he's some mastermind of
you have gimmick. I have not done that.
Well, some people have. I've used the term because I was like, maybe not, like, it was some more of like a comparison of trying to cross the line, you know, like trying to cross the line between theater.
You just said, you just did a people are saying type of thing right there to wipe that away. I saw that.
Well, I mean, I'm not the only one to have said that. I'm just saying, like, he's kind of given that vibe, but when you see that kind of thing, it goes right back into just kind of too crass and crude and just, you know, tasteless. And I feel like that's where he's at. And at some point, that's going to catch up to you. So, no, I feel like it was inevitable at some point he was going to piss everybody off enough where they move on from him.
Yeah, it's not surprising that he's out of there. I mean, the thing is, like, shtick or no shtick, you know, like, whatever it is, like, what percentage of it is him kind of creating this persona and what percentage of it is him just as a person? He's not funny. Like, it's not fun. You know, we've talked about this so many times. Like, after a while, it's just probably draining just to be around that all the time. You know, it's like, just, I would imagine that that's not the fun personality to have around the gym. Plus, then he is crossing the line on his own teammates and, you know, saying terrible things all the time. It's like, it just wears thin. So no, it's not surprising that he's out of there. It's going to be really interesting to see where he lands, you know, who's going to be coaching him or what the situation is. Right. Well, who would want to take him?
That's the part that really intrigues me, because for everything that surrounds this guy, all the baggage that comes with him, he is someone who is 32 years old in the prime of his career and is probably one of the two best welterweights in the world, if not top three. There's a lot to like there if you're a team, but there's also, I mean, like you said, there's so much baggage that comes with it. I wonder if he's going to sort of derail where his trajectory, derail what he should have been, because ATT is a tremendous team, one of the best teams in the entire country. Like, that's not really entire world. Like, that's not something that you can easily replace, especially when you've made a lot of enemies along the way. This is a guy who should be a top contender for the next several years to come. Hopefully this doesn't derail it for him, but we'll see. I mean, maybe I'm saying hopefully in the grander sense. I'm sure some people would definitely enjoy that. But let's keep it moving. Last two topics of the day. You know, we had to get to this at some point. Conor McGregor's GOAT list. Look, I don't care about this. I'm just going to preface this right out front. I don't care about this. He upset a lot of people with this one. He ends up doing this whole Twitter thread, calls Anderson Silva the GOAT, says he has a strong case to be tied at number one with Anderson, and then generously puts GSP and John Jones behind him on that pecking order. You guys know me. I could not give less of an S about this. He's just looking for attention, and everybody is too happy to give it to him. But this did prompt an interesting discussion among us, which is one that I had never really considered. How far down on your GOAT list is Conor McGregor? Like, is he top 10, top 20?
Wow.
Is he even on there? What do you think?
That's a toughie, man. You know, I'm one of those guys who I really don't discount what he's been able to do. I know some people tend to do that in many ways. I've heard a lot of people kind of poo-pooing his achievements based on when he caught certain guys in their careers and not defending the belt, all that stuff. But I think if you really look at what he's been able to do, man, it's pretty remarkable, man. I mean, really, like, it's a pretty crazy thing. I would probably have him, if you're talking like, man, I'd probably have him in like the lower half of the top 10, you
Whoa.
Know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Really? Like maybe 8 or 9. But okay. I don't really, I never really contemplate GOATs. Like, you know, I don't sit around thinking like who's the best, other than like kind of the obvious guys like GSP and Anderson, so things like that. There are certain guys who distinguish themselves for such a long period of time. But I do believe, man, that he's, I think he is that good. Obviously, like his only real big crazy, like where he was outmatched was the Nurmagomedov in terms of his UFC run.
I mean, he lost to Nate Diaz.
He did, but that was crazy circumstance too, man. It going up in weight and short notice, all that. It was kind of, I don't know. I place a little bit more of an asterisk on that type of thing, but you know, I don't know.
I'd be
totally fine if you were like, well, I don't even have him in my top 10. I mean, to me, that he's that kind of guy. Like it depends on how you want to value what he's been able to do.
So you said you have him at the bottom end probably of your top 10, sort of that.
I would probably say, like, if I really broke it down, he'd probably be like 8 or 9.
So for me, because I'm a psychopath, I did that this morning.
Okay.
I wrote my entire
you are
goat
a psychopath.
List. I am. I'm weird with this type of stuff. And I wrote my entire goat list out because I've never actually done this. And I was just curious, like, where would I put this guy? To me,
Vicente Luque, Kevin Randleman. Who else? Just kidding. Go ahead, man.
I'm waiting. You can keep going.
Well, Drew Dober's now on
there. Drew Dober's on this list.
I could probably put
now.
Together a top 10 of Sean's guys. I could probably do that.
Yeah. Get some Drew Dober in there. Get some Tony Ferguson in there. Justin Gaethje. To me, there's a top 7 that you immediately start with that are locks, whatever order you want to throw these people in. But no one is getting past this top 7. You tell me what you think.
Okay.
GSP, John Jones, Anderson Silva, Demetrius Johnson, Khabib Nurmagomedov, Amanda Nunes, Daniel Cormier.
Yeah, see, that's what I mean. I haven't sat and done this like you, but you're 100% right. All of those guys would be locks.
Yeah, so totally right. Well, and that's the thing. All the people that Conor mentioned, as he's mentioning them, like, well, they're all ahead of you, obviously. Like, you're not ahead of them.
Yeah.
So let's keep playing this out, because I think there's still another group that I would still put Conor behind. Because this is where it gets murky, but I would still put all these people ahead of Conor, again, in whatever order you want. Jose Aldo, Fedor, Dominic Cruz, Stipe Miocic, Dan Henderson, Randy Couture, and Henry Cejudo.
Oof, Yeah, you get the Cejudo one, I think, is legit. I mean, all of those are legit names. I'm just, you start
in
to get into
in terms of longevity and accomplishments and not just true. Big stuff, like the big events. It feels
yes,
like
and we've seen
you got
like
defend
for most
titles,
of those guys,
things like that.
Yeah, and for most of those guys, their career played out a lot longer, so you have the bigger sample size. I feel like Conor, we're still waiting to see just how far he'll take it. You know what I mean? If you wanted to put all those guys ahead of him, I would totally understand that, honestly. Like, I feel like Conor's that kind of weird. He's got that kind of weird career trajectory. I tend to value what he's done, though. You know what I mean? Like, maybe more than other people, but I would have him ahead of a couple of those names for sure.
Like who? I'm just curious.
Well, let's see. So, like you mentioned,
Aldo,
Dan Henderson.
Fedor, Cruz, yeah. Miocic, Henderson, Randy, and Cejudo.
It's tough to say. I'm not one of those guys just because he knocked out Aldo that you say, like, well, of course he's better than Aldo. But, you know, because Aldo ran, he was there for so long. You know what I mean? But I would put, it's hard for me not to do it either. It's almost like I'd have to have them kind of neck and neck, but I could go either way on that one. I would probably put him ahead of Dan Henderson in the end.
That's the only one out of that list that I was like, maybe he could be ahead of Hendo. But Sean, I completely agree with you. The thing that is just glaring to me is that he's never defended a title. That is
crucial.
Exactly.
Well, I feel like that's the big mark on him, right? Yeah. That's the big mark on
him. That's a fundamental like truth in the sport that everybody goes, you're not really a champion until you defend a belt. Like that's
true.
Absolutely just something that is said. That's like a truism in MMA. And he's never done it. That stands out to me. I agree with you. I would put him behind all those guys, maybe Hendo being the exception. But yeah, I mean, he's not even close to the top five in my mind.
Yeah, I know this is all my opinion, but to me, longevity matters. Defending titles matters. Fun fights against Nate Diaz and Donald Cerrone, they're fun, but they don't vault you up that list. So for me, I would put Conor in sort of that sort of group with like a Big Nog, Matt Hughes, Chris Cyborg, Michael Bisping, those borderline top 20 people.
Yeah,
that's sort of where I would have.
It'd be tough to argue it, and I do agree with you guys. Like we really do place true stock and defenses, right? I think that kind of shows your mettle. You're no longer gunning for something. You're protecting something. I feel like that mentality is something we cherish in the fight game. I would like to see him in those situations, but I will say that the scrutiny has been so huge on him and through the escalations of every event, and he has done it. Like, he's been able to navigate himself in a way that I give him a little more credit that some people might have wilted, you know what I mean, under the spotlight a little earlier. He hasn't really done that yet. And even in this last fight with Donald Cerrone, that's showing up, and I know Donald Cerrone, where he's at and all that stuff, but just to perform and, you know, on that, to do it just like that, I just feel like he's got, there's more to him, you know what I mean, than just the title defenses, let's say.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that, but that's the thing. I mean, I agree with you, but that's a different conversation. I think if you talk about, you know, GOATs in terms of influence, in terms of changing the sport and all that stuff, the magnitude of the moment, he's probably number one, right? I mean, he puts himself conversation. But when it comes to the actual competition of wiping out a division or, you know, consecutive title defenses, he's not in that conversation. True. And I think he hurt himself. I mean, the projection or the potential was always there. He was on that road. But he climbed it so quickly, then he goes to the Mayweather fight. It's like he takes himself out of that conversation with, you know...
I agree, man.
...getting to that different stratosphere in terms of money and fame. But he's not better than Jon Jones. You know what I mean? Jon Jones has been there forever. So it is what it is. Like, you know, maybe he can get there one day, but he's not there now.
Well, we could go on endlessly about this. So let's keep it moving. We already gave Conor the attention that he wanted. So there you go, Conor. Last item of the day, and I find this just to be delightful, I have to say. On May 17th, HBO had talked about the UFC very briefly on Last Week Tonight. They talked about Fight Island, and they very blatantly suggested, like, hey, UFC, why didn't you just call it UFC with S-E-A at the end? Which is, I mean, that's pretty great. I don't know how none of us thought of that for weeks on end. Not one of us thought of it. We're writers, but come on, man. May 19th rolls around. So 2 days later, as reported by Josh Gerben, the UFC files for 4 trademark applications for, of course, UFC, spelled that exact way. 2 days later, 2 days after Last Week Tonight airs. I find all of this to be hilarious. Chuck, Chris, where do you guys stand? Yay or nay on UFC? Is that better or worse than Fight Island?
I say nay, man. I don't know. This is just, it's like a strange homonym. Like, I don't know. It's just, it's kind of funny that the UFC ran with this, though, because it did get a lot of attention from John Oliver. But really what he was doing was bad-mouthing the UFC, which I think is kind of funny, you know, that they kind of turned this into an opportunity to brand it. I'll give the UFC credit for kind of rolling with the punches on this one. But I don't know, man. That's kind of cheesy to me.
I love it. I got to be honest. I think that's the beauty of it. Like, I think that's what makes MMA and the UFC so special, is that they are kind of being made fun of, but they go, well, that's funny, and they're going to take it, and they're going to run with it. Like, they're selling Fight Island t-shirts. They're going to sell UFC t-shirts. Like, I'm into it because it is so absurd. They're making, you know, lemonade out of lemons. It's such a crazy situation that they're going to have an octagon on the beach and do all this shit. It's like, it's fun to me. I mean, I like it.
Yeah.
I like it too. I'm not going to lie. I'm with you, Chris. I don't know that I like it better than Fight Island. I think John Oliver last week tonight, what they had said about Fight Island was actually pretty on point of like, that's the stupidest name that you could give this and the simplest name, but it's also in a way the best name.
Right.
Yeah.
Because it is just so weird in us. It's such an MMA idea. I like UFC, but I think I do like Fight Island better.
Yeah.
And as we said,
nobody went with mine. I said the Isle of Wight. Come on. It's a slam dunk.
That is solid. It's a little highbrow. Maybe,
It's not. It's not it's solid. Don't give him your pin.
Here's the.
Landline.
Let me get that. Hold on, fellas. Just kidding. Come on now.
Who is calling you all the time at this every show?
It's right now. It's the in-laws. I don't know. It's always somebody different.
You know what's interesting? I think we're definitely going to refer to it as Fight Island. I mean, I'm going to refer to it as Fight Island, but. You know, when we have a pay-per-view, it's UFC 250. When it's on the island, it'll be UFC SEA, whatever number. Hmm. You know, maybe they'll start renumbering.
Are we starting up another number system?
Yeah, exactly. Maybe that's how they'll...
we don't have enough of those. I like that.
Yeah. I know.
Oh, man. MMA is so stupid. I love it. Always brings us interesting things to talk about. Anyway, let's close out the show. It is Wednesday. You guys know what that means. It's interim title time, baby. And I'll actually, Chuck, normally I give you the floor first. I actually want to take this one first, because for my interim title this week, this is unfortunately not a happy one. And although there is some level of positivity just to see the MMA community rally in the way that they have. But if you haven't seen it, tragic news hitting the MMA world, retired UFC lightweight Sam Stout and his wife Jessie recently suffering the loss of their 1-month-old daughter, Sydney Love Stout, this past week. Just devastating news for the Stout family. I can't even imagine. If you would like to help, a GoFundMe has been started by a family friend to help the Stouts basically just deal with everything over this time. It was only originally shooting for $5,000. And as of this writing, I just checked before we started recording, it is approaching $30,000. So nice. Good on you, MMA community. Go donate if you can. And best wishes to the Stout family. I can't imagine how difficult this must be. So keep them in your thoughts. And they are my interim title winners of the week.
And you know something else, Sean? Sam is one of the good guys in this game, man. I don't know how many times you've talked to him or if you've talked to him at length, but he is actually one of the really great guys in this game. Always very down to earth. Had many conversations. So, yeah, heart goes out to the Stout family. And hopefully they can get through this very difficult time, man. I'm gonna swing mine in a different direction. You know, our boy Kevin Holland, who just fought a couple of weeks ago, and scored a victory in his fight against Anthony Hernandez, was trying to make a 2-week turnaround and fight in a different weight class, a lower one at welterweight from middleweight on this card coming up this weekend. He was all gung ho to do it, and I thought it was pretty cool because he was one of those guys who I thought stood out in Jacksonville, like where you're like, this guy's stock kind of went way up. I thought his stock went even further up to be taking a fight on short notice. It seemed like he might be ready to kind of shake up. You know, people's perception of what, you know, who he is and all that stuff. But unfortunately, he had to pull out with an injury. And I was kind of bummed, man. I was kind of bummed when I saw that he wasn't going to fight. I wanted to see how he did. It kind of reminded me of Chris Lieben, who had a 2-week turnaround one time and scored a couple of victories right in a row like that. I wanted to see it. It didn't happen for him. But just because he wanted to and he tried before he pulled out with the injury, I think that's good enough for my interim title this week.
I love it. Wasn't Chris Lieben trying to, when he did it, wasn't that the Akiyama fight?
Yeah, the Akiyama fight. Yep, exactly. It just seemed like at the time, you know, he was kind of still high profile. You know what I mean? Like, he was still enough up there where you're like, you had to pay attention to him. So it was kind of risky, but he pulled it off. And I was like, that's got to be like the greatest 2 weeks of his life. You know what I mean? To get all that money and everything else that he got there.
Yeah, actually, I'm looking at it right now. Other than like the very beginning of his UFC career when he was the Crippler and he was, you know, he was a really devastating guy. That was the best run that he had in the UFC throughout his entire career, because he punches out Aaron Simpson. And then you're right. Like 10, 12 days later, he fights Yoshihiro Akiyama and submits him. Fight of the night, knockout of the night, back to back. That was a good
money.
That was a good little stretch.
Yeah.
The Crippler Chris Liebman. Good stuff, man. Love it.
Yeah.
That is it for us today. Thank you so much, y'all, for joining us on another episode here of The Man and the Myth. We really do appreciate it. It's good to be back. We will be back normal time next week, Monday and Wednesday. So in the meantime, hope you guys really enjoy your week. Enjoy the weekend. Enjoy the fights. Stay safe out there. For producer Chris, that man is Chuck Mendenhall. I am Sean Ashadi. Please go rate, review, subscribe on Apple Podcasts. It really does help us out. You already knew that, though. In the meantime, we'll catch you guys on Monday. Love ya.
Peace.